Hello there, one and all. He's Ralph, I'm Peter, so let's do this. Today, we're going to talk about two things. Firstly, we're going to be talking about ExxonMobil's continued pressure on ESG investors. And secondly, we'll be talking about how global supply chains are changing from being ones based on efficiency to ones based more on geopolitical risk. So, in the first... For the first topic, at the moment, ExxonMobil has basically taken a couple of ESG investors on. Because they allege that the ESG investors are pressuring them to, do things in their business which goes against their overall business. And that's one thing, but actually another interesting thing about this is actually the two investors that are that they're taking to task in the law courts actually don't have very big the shareholding. So we're talking, I think one of them has something like £51,000 worth of a holding, so it's not like they own a massive percentage of the company. So I think that's the main objection here, or one of the main objections, is that this, if this works, they are going to open the floodgates to loads of investors to do certain, this kind of thing with actually relatively low shareholdings. So that's one thing. This is potentially a danger for ESG. But the other thing as well is that maybe the principles of what they're doing with the ESG could be applied to all shareholders. So it will have much broader implications, because for the purposes of this, it's almost like ESG is a type of activist shareholder, which they are. That's what they're kind of doing with this moment. So the idea is, if this goes against them, that could mean that all activist investors will be restricted. But what do you think about this, Ralph?
Yeah, as ever, it's a more multifaceted issue, isn't it? I mean, the first thing is, it's not actually really ESG investment. As such, I mean, ESG investment is a sort of general umbrella of investing in companies which are held to perform in accordance with certain standards, held to be ethical. And we've discussed that before. And that is, of course, an entirely worthwhile and valid way to direct your investments. But within the umbrella of ESG investment, there may easily lie a source of investment which is more, let's say, philosophy based or ideology based. And this is, I think, what we're seeing here. So I wouldn't, while it is in the context of ESG investment that we are seeing this dynamic unfold, I would use the word to describe it, which you mentioned in your introduction. I would call that activist investment. Mm-hmm. An activist investment is, of course, not a new thing. We've seen that before, where certain funds, hedge funds, have accumulated sufficiently strong share positions to have a vote at the AGM in order to urge certain decisions, exclude members from the board, militate against the re-election of the chairman, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. And while it is therefore not new to see activist investments, I think what is new, perhaps, is the disproportionate impact which can be had through just the ownership of a few shares. And I must admit, I don't know exactly how this works. It cannot be enshrined in the mechanical way in which this works, because you only have a few votes at the AGM and no more. But I think these people are more vociferous than meets the eye, and they're sort of punching above their own weight in this way. Now, pausing here, maybe there's a bigger philosophical issue to solve first, or a bigger philosophical question to ask first. And this is, well, some might say, well, fine, ExxonMobil may not like this, but they are owners of the company, co-owners of the company, shareholders. Should they not have a say over how the company is being managed? And this is a valid question. And I think we need to sort of think about this for a moment first. And what I would say, therefore, is first of all, so what is a reasonable mandate that a shareholder of a publicly quoted company should legitimately have or could legitimately have? I would argue it is to make an investment in the pursuit of a financial return. Indeed, it is the mandate of the shareholder to maximize this return, which drives a professional investment, which is embedded in funds and fund management. Now, I would argue if such a return cannot be produced through the investment of a company whose management style may not be in accordance with what the investor wants, then the investor should take the money and invest it in a company where the management style is in accordance with what they want. And what they want, of course, is nothing more nefarious than the maximization of their financial return. Sorry.
I was just going to say, this is a posh way of saying, if you don't like what you see, take your money and just go and invest it elsewhere, kind of thing.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, sorry. I'm just bringing it down to bring it up. Anyway, yeah, go
yes,
ahead.
Or only
if you don't like it, just pick your money up and, oh, I can't
if
say,
you
but
don't
yeah.
like it, roll it up.
Yeah.
Only with a slight sort of subtle difference is that the way you described it would be the dialogue between the management of the company and the shareholders. The management would say to the companies, if you don't like it, guess what, you know? Whereas I would say that it's the dialogue between the shareholders and the management. If I don't like what I see, then I take my money and go elsewhere. This is slightly different, but yeah, nuanced, but sort of essentially the same. The net effect is the same. So the question is that actually a reasonable response or not? And I would say it is, because it is if you believe that a legitimate mandate or interest of the an investor in a company is to maximize financial return. I would say it is. That is the reason why I would invest in companies. That's the reason why most shareholders do, or most people who become shareholders do. Now, there is, of course, a legitimate question. Is it not legitimate for a group of shareholders to come together and perhaps use the holding to exert influence or pressure on management so that management could adopt a style that would lead to a maximization of return in the view of the shareholder group, so that indeed they are still in line with what I just said, i.e. the mandate is to maximize return. If it can't be done by watching the management do their job, then management has to be urged to do a better job. And that, yeah, it is debatable. To an extent, I think that can be argued that that might be legitimate, but it is already pushing against the obviously legitimate role of the shareholder. I would say that in the case of Exxon, that line has been crossed. And the reason I say that is that Exxon is a company whose business model is to be an oil company. Its raison d'etre is to maximize profits, one hopes, in an ethical way, from oil-related business. Let's keep it as loose as possible. If that particular business model, which is entirely transparent and clear to everybody, militates against the philosophical or perhaps ideological worldview of some, then I would argue that that the accumulation of a shareholding in that company for the purpose of changing the management style towards a style which veers away from that business model and adopts a business model which is more in line with ecological goals of that particular group, but against the original business model of the company. That is where you cross the line, because then the shareholder's mandate flips from return maximization towards promotion of a particular ideological view. And that, I think, and I don't know exactly where we are on this spectrum. You see, there is a spectrum. I can tell you it is legitimate if a shareholder wants to maximize returns. I know where that is on the spectrum. And I can tell you it is illegitimate, in my view, if a shareholder wants to use their holdings in order to promote a particular ideological view. I don't believe that is the legitimate role of a shareholder. So I can point out, so these are the two points on the spectrum which I can identify, and the latter one has crossed the line, which is somewhere else. And so from that point of view, I would answer my original question now and say that I would believe that the action of the activist investors in this particular case of ExxonMobil, which we are commenting on here, is adopting an illegitimate role for a shareholder, and it is therefore ethically justifiable for Exxon to go against it. And I thought this was, at least to me, and you guys, of course, have no choice in listening to me. You can switch off. But apart from that,
I locked
the doors. So I thought it was an interesting general framework into which to put our assessment here. Now, if you guys agree, or even if you don't, if you adopt this particular framework of analysis, then it would indeed follow that Exxon has a legitimate case to make. And if that case turns out to be made in its favor, then we will have in case law, a precedent judgment which will modify, perhaps preclude similar activity or action of activist investors in future. And to the extent that all of this has played out, is playing out in the context of ESG, it might also modify the extent to which ESG investments themselves are seen to be a legitimate or appropriate way to direct investment decisions. So that is the sort of wider field in which this judgment, which is about to, I believe, come, will sit. And so we need to watch this space and see what is going to happen.
Definitely. I mean, you know, one other thought, I think I mentioned this in Watson's Daily, was that maybe ExxonMobil thinks that this is a good time to do this, because ESG has been under a lot of pressure, a lot of negative press over the last year or so, because, you know, lots of investment managers have been greenwashing their funds. And so now that ESG, after many years of being seen as the best thing ever, is now on the back foot. They see the oil companies see weakness, and they're basically going for the jugular. So I think that this is interesting timing. We'll have to see how it goes. But, you know, I think that this will have impact not only on ESG investing, but activist investing in general.
Yeah, and especially also perhaps it will have an impact on the potential trend within ESG investment to become perhaps more extreme and veer into something which we could call, I mean, you guys know I like extreme sports, like extreme skiing and stuff. So this is extreme ESG investment, and that would be activist investment. And we know, of course, that this is happening all the time. Certain things are developing from a reasonable base. You know, there's another word very loosely defined now, which is known as wokeism. And to the extent that this is, for example, based on a general idea for societies to become more inclusive, not discriminatory, all these ideas are, of course, fantastic. And then it is, well, they are fantastic in the sense that they are legitimate and desirable. But sometimes the pendulum swings the other way. And what we've seen, what we are seeing are unintended consequences as certain actions emerge, which are more extreme than the original intent. And as a, this was just an analogy, and this might actually be happening in ESG if the idea that you can promote your ideology more vigorously by using an activist investment angle takes hold. If it takes hold, if the activist investors succeed, then it would easily spread. And I would say that is not going to be, that's going to be to the detriment of the entire investment model in the first place. So to that extent, yeah, absolutely. We will have to see how this goes. And if there is a precedent judgment to come, then this would be, I think, very important more than in more than one way.
Absolutely. So there we go. Okay, let's move on to the second topic now. So there was a very good quote by someone who was from, so the Antonio Gabriel, the global economist of the Bank of America. And I thought he made a really good statement when he said that global supply chains are gradually shifting their approach from one based on efficiency to one increasingly based on geopolitical risk management. Now, this is in regards to the story that Mexico has overtaken China as the biggest exporter to America, which is pretty amazing. And this actually is the manifestation of what this guy Antonio Gabriel said, which is, which is essentially that in the past everyone has graduated to the cheapest, most efficient place to get their stuff. So, for instance, under during the COVID years, we realized that China was the world's factory. Made all sorts of things. We learnt that I think it was Malaysia, but I'm sorry if I'm wrong. It might is the one that had something like 60% market share of the world's production of rubber gloves for surgery.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So there's that kind of thing. And you know, and tech is predominantly, so chips that power everything, predominantly in Asia. In China, but very much in Taiwan, for instance. Now, I mentioned in Watson's Yearly this year a number of themes, but two of them that specifically pertain to what I'm just saying today are the ones where we're talking about nearshoring and more deglobalization. Now, there's a subtle difference, I think, between those two. So what I would say is with more deglobalization, I'm thinking more about us thinking, well, in the past, we may have said, right, we'll get our chips from that country or that, you know, that region. We'll get our rubber gloves from this country. We'll get our this from this, you know, and you go like that. So you are using the supply of the whole world, but actually what we will be moving towards is possibly more nearshoring, in the sense that we will be looking to bring production closer to where the end market is. And I think that this is happening because whereas in the past you might have said, you know, you might have taken certain relations between certain countries and regions as being, you know, taken as red and everything's fine. But the problem is that, you know, the way, so with Russia invading Ukraine, with China moving away from engagement with the West and more engagement with the likes of Putin and others, suddenly what we have learnt over many decades may be going out of the window. And as a result of which, this is creating uncertainty, which, as we know, businesses hate. And therefore, this means that this means that companies and industries are having to take into account geopolitical risk in more areas and more seriously than perhaps they have in the past. And so I think this is a really interesting subject. But what do you think, Ralph?
Absolutely. It's hugely fascinating. And I think we did discuss it already in the podcast where we talk about themes, the themes podcast, which is sort of, I think, two episodes ago. Mm-hmm. We discussed very much these things. And I was interested to see the chief economist of Bank of America basically elevating, in his view, geopolitical risk to one of the most important determinants of who to do business with, of who to trade. So in this context, let me just reminisce for a moment, if that's a word. So I'm going to do a quick history since the Second World War. It's only going to, to take about 6 hours, so don't go away. No, the joking aside, it's going to be quick. So with the Second World War, a new world order emerged, and then after the Second World War, basically we lived in a duopolar. I'm trying to avoid the word bipolar here. So two poles, two big blocks. In a two-block world, one is clearly the USA and the West, and the other one was the Soviet Union and the communist countries. And then after the fall of the Berlin Wall, now in the 90s, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, basically the Soviet Union, the communist bloc disappeared, and we had a brief moment, well, measured in a decade or maybe even 15 years, where America was the only leading political bloc country in the world, a monopolar world. And we're now moving into, I think, something which is going to be at least a tripolar world, with the US and the West on one side, and then obviously a reinvigorating Russia and China, or maybe you could say perhaps it's going to be duopolar again, with China leading a consolidating block of autocratic countries in a similar way as the USA was leading a consolidated block of industrial countries. That's the sort of world into which we are moving, and I think we are solidly in this new world already. And in this new world, of course, geopolitical risk, which in itself has always existed, of course, is taking on a different shape or form. Geopolitical risk, and this is what you said, is now housed, is domiciled in countries which are different from those where we identified it before. And clearly it is now in Russia. We discussed that before. Unless Russia completely changes its stance in decades to come, it is going to remain a very forcible threat to at least Europe, but by extension the world. And any business which is domiciled in the Western world is going to find it difficult to do trade with Russia, or at the very least, it's going to have difficulty persuading the board of directors in the company to actually put manufacturing facilities back into Russia, because clearly the political risk is high and it is unpredictable. That's the important thing here. It's unpredictable what is going to happen. So if you now take that. And if you accept that geopolitical risk is A, more important, I think, than it has been during the time that we lived in a monopolar world, perhaps up to 2000, the noughties, and B, that geopolitical risk is taking up a different shape or form, it's now in different countries, then the decision of where to do business is going to be driven increasingly by geopolitical risk. This is exactly what the boss, the chief economist of Bank of America, said. And in the context of what we discussed, deglobalization and nearshoring, it's interesting because there is another, at least one other element which determines, as countries, with whom you are going to trade. And that is, in economics, I think it is known as the law of gravity. And that doesn't actually describe anything more complicated than the fact that you trade with those who are closest to you. So this is territorial proximity, nearshoring, as you said. That's the reason why the single market has developed. All European countries trade with each other because they are in close proximity to each other, but also, of course, because they represent very little political risk. That is why the USA has traded traditionally more with Canada than with Australia and is now increasingly trading with Mexico. And that is also the reason why, sorry, I can't help myself, the decision to leave the single market was presumably based at least in part on a misreading of the global map, where people thought Australia was just next to Surrey, which it isn't, because it's halfway around the world. So the law of gravity clearly speaks for the single market. And before people think I'm going to be an activist investor, you know, pushing my ideology down people's, I'm going to stop. But obviously, this is the law of gravity. So if you think about some other factors which determine which economy does business with what other economy, we have two very important ones here already. One is territorial proximity. One is increasingly now geopolitical risk. Then there are some others, which is a heightened sensitivity to the issue of ethical manufacturing. So if you, for example, wish to put your manufacturing base into a country which uses child labor or something, this has never been a good idea, but it is, well, I can't believe that people have ever thought, oh, this is excellent, you know. But maybe in past decades, people were, in the interest of profit, sort of happy to ignore this. And this is increasingly going to be no longer possible. Linking up, by the way, to ESG investments and proving that ESG investments, if it doesn't lead to activist investment, is actually not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So this is one thing. And then what do we have? There's one other thing which I wanted to... Oh, yes, regulation, single market again. If you have a free trade agreement, any kind of trade agreement which limits the economic friction costs like tariffs, then that is another reason why you would actually do business with such a country, not with another. And in this, I mentioned four, there are some more, but in this list or skein of factors, geopolitical risk is, I think, now emerging to become one of the, if not the most important factor that determines what country is doing business with whom. And as I said in the themes podcast, I would not be surprised if in the tripolar world in which we, I think, already live, we are going to see an increasing number of like free trade agreements or other forms of of treaties between countries, especially those which are territorial near to each other, to the extent that these countries present little political risk. And I think within that particular framework of analysis, if you accept it, that would be the reason why we're seeing now Mexico overtaking China as a trading partner with the USA. Just two final additional points on this. One reason of that is, of course, that China's economy is currently in a bit of a bad shape. There's a risk of deflation looming. It is not contracting, but it is certainly not growing as fast as it used to be. So it is easier to overtake it, so to speak. And the other reason is sort of like a bit of a doom-mongering look into the future. In another era, Trump, you may well see that another geopolitical tendency might trump. Oh, sorry, that was not intended.
Don't worry. Might
dominate a tendency to do business with those countries which represent low geopolitical risk. And that tendency is isolationism. If America goes by the policy of America first, then it doesn't matter whether other countries represent low political risk or not. He just would never do any business with Mexico if he could. So it is unclear, therefore, where the future is going to be headed. But again, I would be surprised if in the long run we see more of these types of free trade agreements. I think that political stability, or perceived political stability, is going to be one of the most important determinants of in the choice of who to do business with as a country. And I would say that the attractiveness of existing free trade agreements, such as NAFTA in the North American continent, or the single market in Europe, or or the customs union, which also exists in Europe, are going to be highlighted in future.
Fair enough. I mean, that's one of the reasons. I mean, I think it was last year where we saw Goldman Sachs launching their own institutes on, that was the sole sort of reason for coming to fruition, was the increased demand from clients for advice on geopolitical risk. And there is clearly a market for this, and I think that, you know, there's going to continue to be an even bigger market, because things that we have taken for granted can now not necessarily be what we thought. And so there will be increased need for guidance on this, I think.
Indeed. You see, the trouble with geopolitical risk, I think, is that it is genuinely very difficult to predict a geopolitical development in the future. I think it is much harder than the prediction of earnings, which of course was my bread and butter for 20 years. And I don't know whether I ever mentioned this, but I have a short stint as a political analyst in the Bundestag, which is German parliament. This was ages ago. And even then I thought, wow, I mean, the data on which I have to work here are just basically so open to interpretation, but I just absolutely have no idea what is going to happen. Anybody out there who read Isaac Asimov's Foundation novels, which is the same thing. In that one, he portrayed a group of professional historian predictors, and they were blown out of the water by developments which they could not foresee. So, for example, if you look at the Middle East specifically, I think no prizes for guessing. If I was a political analyst like 2 or 5 years ago, working for Goldman Sachs, for example, in the newly set up geopolitical risk department, I would of course say, well, I mean, there's a huge potential political risk here because of the known factors. And it could explode or like any minute, more or less. And look at that. It hasn't quite exploded yet, thank God, and hopefully it won't. But, well, it has sort of exploded a little bit, if that's a possibility. And the one thing which I would say to that is, even when or even after the terror organization Hamas basically invaded, more or less, Israel, and even then, it was sort of clear to everybody, I think, that this could, of course, ripple out into the region. But the exact way in which it is playing out now was unclear at the time. I mean, at the moment, we have the Houthis endangering passing ship traffic, and we commented on this last episode. Increasing inflation because of the increased freight costs. But even in that particular dynamic, which we now know is happening and which we may not have been able to predict with compelling confidence in October, even that particular dynamic appears to be less pronounced than it meets the eye. Maybe you guys remember, and I'm going to do this again now, maybe you guys remember that last time I was looking at the containerized freight index, and I was describing that the cost shot up during the Ukraine war, then it collapsed again, and recently it shot up again, but it is sort of almost at one third of its peak, of its historic peak in the Ukraine crisis. And at the time I was saying, well, I can't really see from the data here where this is going to go. Is it going to go further, is it going to go sideways? I can now reveal that it has gone sideways. It hasn't gone up further. And I think the reason for that might be that there is now overcapacity emerging in the cargo ship sector, as lots and lots of orders which were placed during the pandemic crisis for cargo ships are coming good, and we have overcapacity in the market, and that is dampening prices while the Houthi militant activity is increasing prices. And I think that is hanging in the balance now. Who knows where this is going to go? But just as one element of how geopolitical analysis would feed into economic analysis, that's exactly the sort of thing which you would do if you were employed by Goldman Sachs in the new department. And now, of course, it is still anybody's guess where this is going to go. Would you now invest in the region? At the moment, you wouldn't. But would you invest in cargo ship companies? Well, this is the sort of question. You would if you thought that you can, with some confidence, predict that the freight cost is going to top out and come down. But there is, of course, an element of uncertainty in this, and this is all tied up with the geopolitical situation which we have referenced, and the difficulty which is inherent in a prediction of these dynamics.
Absolutely. But again, you know, this is all good stuff, and you know, brings up a number of different themes. Like I say, these themes have been echoed in Watson's yearly. So again, I'll be updating that with this extra stuff, because Watson's yearly goes throughout the whole year, and the idea is it's supposed to update as time goes on, so that you can look back at it at the end of the year. But anyway, do you have anything else to add, Ralph?
No, just that it was my pleasure to refer to the containerized freight index again. I'm going to try to get this in every time now.
Nice.
This replaces inflation.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about that now.
Our next favorite, next sort of big favorite subject. Brilliant. Good. Anyway.
Excellent.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much. As always, brilliant to talk to you. Thank you very much for listeners, for viewers, watching, listening. And we'll be with you again very soon.
Thanks for listening, guys. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.